We cut our presentation down to a very concise half hour. But we have to start now. Otherwise, we're going to cut into Phil Rubenstein's time, and we don't want to do that under any circumstances. So first thing, I'm gonna open up this panel with a poem by Friedrich Schiller called The Pledge. And we're not going to talk about it. I'm just going to read it. To Dionysius, the tyrant, would sneak Damon, concealing a dagger. He's slapped by the guards in a fetter. What would you do with that dagger? Speak, demands the despot, his visage bleak. I would free the state from a tyrant. For that, on the cross be repentant. I am, he replies, ready to die, and do not beseech you to spare me. But if you would show me mercy, I ask you to let 3 days go by, till my sister her marriage bonds may tie. I'll leave you my friend in bondage, if I flee his life his hostage. The king then smiles with malice in his face, and speaks after thinking just briefly. 3 days I'll give you for your journey, but beware, if you've used up your days of grace, before you've returned to me from that place, then he must to death be committed, but your sentence will be remitted. And he comes to his friend. The king bids that I must pay by crucifixion for my wrongful act of passion, but he will let 3 days go by, till my sister her marriage bonds may tie, so stay as my pledge, till I hasten back to you your bonds to unfasten. And the true friend embraces him silently, and goes to the tyrant in submission. The other goes hence on his mission. And before the sun rises upon the third day, he quickly gives his sister in marriage away, hurries home with anxious spirit, that he stay not beyond the time limit. Then the rain comes pouring down endlessly. From the mountains the springs are rushing, and the brooks and the streams are gushing. To the bank with his wanderer's staff comes he, as the whirlpool is tearing the bridge away, and the waves now break with a thunder, the arch of the vault asunder. And hopeless he wanders the shore's dark sand, as widely as he scouts and gazes, and as loud as the cries he raises, here no boat puts out from safety's strand, which brings him across to the wished-for land. No skipper mans his station, and the wild stream swells to an ocean. Then he sinks on the shore and prays and cries, his hands up to Zeus extended. Oh, let the storm's wrath be ended! The hours are hastening, at midday lies the sun, and if it leaves the skies and I cannot reach the city, then my friend must die without pity. But renewed, the rage of the storm does grow, and wave upon wave goes racing, and hour after hour is chasing. His courage he seizes, his fear makes him go, and headlong he dives in the thundering flow, and cleaves in a powerful fashion the flood, and the god has compassion. And he wins the bank, and runs from the flood, and thanks to the gods he expresses, when a band of robbers then presses from out a nocturnal spot in the wood, his pathway blocking, and snorts for his blood, and holds up the wanderers speeding with threatening cudgels impeding. What do you want? He cries, pale with fear. I've not but my life to render, which I to the king must surrender. And he grabs the club from the one most near. For the sake of my friend, be merciful here. And three, with a powerful beating, he slays, the others retreating. And the sun glows hot as a burning brand, and from all the pains of his mission, he sinks to his knees in exhaustion. Oh, you save me with mercy from robber's hand, from out of the stream to the sacred land. And shall I here languishing perish, and my friend die for me whom I cherish? And hark, there it pearls silver clear, quite close, like a rippling it rushes. And to listen he halts and hushes. And see, from the rock ledge now babbling near, an ebullient fountain springs murmuring here. And he joyfully kneels down and washes, and his burning limbs refreshes. And the sunlight slants through the verdant trees, and paints on the glistening meadows the forest's gigantic shadows. And two wanderers walking the road he sees, he would hasten along as he passed them he flees. Then he hears the words they are saying, now him on the cross they are slaying. And now fear gives wings to his hastening gait, Pangs of grief are him pursuing, and then shimmering red over the evening, distant Syracuse's towers await. And here Philostratus comes from its gate, the household's honest keeper, who with horror perceives his master. Go back! It's too late to save your friend, so save your own life for the future. Even now to death does he suffer. Your return he awaited for hours on end. To you his hopeful soul did bend, with a faith too strong and valiant to be robbed by the scorn of the tyrant. And is it too late? Can I not lend him the hand of a welcome savior? Then in death I'll join him forever. Let the bloody tyrant's boasting end, that the friend has broken his word to his friend. Let him slaughter us two together, and believe in love and honor. And the sun now descends. By the gate he stands nigh, and sees the cross elevated, which the gaping crowd has awaited. On the rope already his friends lifted high, through the thick of the throng he goes charging by. Me, hangman, kill me, he's crying. I'm the one for whom he is dying. And amazement seizes the people all round. The two friends give each other embraces. Tears of sorrow and joy wet their faces. No eye without tears is there to be found. And the wonderful tale to the king is then bound. Humanely his feelings are shaken. To his throne are they quickly then taken. And long he regards them with wondering eye. Then he speaks. You have prospered, my heart you now have conquered. In true faith, 'tis no empty vanity. So into your friendship's bond take me. I would, if allowed my attention, become the third in your union.
I just wanted to start off by a brief discussion on LaRouche's intervention into world and universal history through the work he's been doing on these specific ideas that we've been discussing this weekend. And the platform that he's put this youth movement on to carry these ideas on into the future. Now, one thing about this idea of a language, it's very beautiful because, well, perhaps we might come out of this cadre school discussing all these wonderful ideas and go back into the city and not know how to communicate them. But one thing that's great is that we can always hark back to these past great leaders and artists and begin to develop their method of communicating ideas. And also, begin to use what we know about history to begin to develop new forms of language, which are going to be necessary in order to head toward a future renaissance. Because as of right now, We have a number of science driver economic programs that are ready to be implemented into and to be launched into the future, and we don't yet know what's going to come out of them. We don't know which type of new technology and new breakthroughs and discoveries will begin to blossom from perhaps the Eurasian land bridge or the information we're getting back from Mars or even Saturn, because right now a lot of these things cannot be explained, and it's very interesting that we now have the task of developing a new language to move humanity in a new direction, and this definitely probably wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for someone like LaRouche and his commitment to mankind, to actually realize that there's a certain power in these ideas, and also know that there's an even greater power in the communication of these ideas. So, yeah, I guess I didn't really prepare too much, but that's yeah.
What I kind of quickly want to do is go through some of the scientific basis for language. What you had following the destruction of most of Europe through a similar type of situation we have now, where you had a banking collapse, which resulted in a massive looting policy by the financial interests of that time, resulting in a massive poverty in the population. And due to the decrease in the healthiness of the population, a plague ravaged Europe and caused a dark age. But Western civilization was actually saved by going back into the history of the ancient Greeks vis-a-vis the Arabs, who, while we were essentially destroying ourselves with the question of who's right, Christians or Catholics or Protestants, they were having a renaissance in the south of Spain. So these ancient ideas came to us by way of first Italy, through Petrarch first, and then to Dante, who was an incredible man of God in the sense that he was a religious man, but he was also the type of religious person that didn't really believe in God the same way that people conventionally did. He believed passionately in the way that only a true artist and a true genius can. And one of the things he was looking at was the actual relationship between art, or rather language in particular, and poetry. Or, to kind of try to get this idea across quickly, he writes a book called De Vulgare Eloquentia, which is basically... It was on the eloquence of the vernacular, or the so-called mother tongue. And he's an Italian, and, you know, of course, Rome was in Italy. So what he's doing is he's going into the post-Roman Italy, looking at all these different languages that are there, something like, you know, thousands of dialects. I mean, it's fairly ridiculous. And he's evaluating them based on the musicality of the dialect. He's actually saying, this one's ugly, this one's beautiful, this works, this doesn't, based upon musical principles. So he divides words into different kinds of categories. He has a group of words called the combed words, which are particular words or ideas, words that are attached to ideas that are necessary for the moral uplifting of mankind. Words like amore, love, donna, lady, disio, desire, virtute, virtue, donare, contribute or give, letizia, happiness, salute, health, securitate, security, difesa, defense. These are combed words. They have these pure vowel sounds, a, e, I, o, u. The Greeks actually developed a way of kind of looking at all the possible vowel sounds the mouth could make, and then you had kind of like a separation. If, you know, the vowel sounds are too close together, you won't be able to tell the difference. But if you have all the possible vowel sounds, so A to I to O, I, O, and O to back to A, so O, A. So you had I, I, U, O, A, something like that. Right? So this is one of the things that Dante was looking at for five pure vowel sounds in the Italian language. And then he also had something called hairy words, which are also related, but, you know, they have little accents on it. So terra, with the rolled R, it means earth or land. Honore, with the aspirated H. Speranza, hope. Gravitate, gravity. Alleviato, alleviated. Impossibilitate, impossibility. Benaventuratissimo, very fortunate. aventuratissimamente, very fortunately, disaventuratissimamente, very unfortunately, sovra magnificentissimamente, very super magnificently. And so one of the great things about Dante is that, so he's organizing for a new language, a beautiful language to uplift man's soul and to bring him in harmony with a society that is actually noble. Well, he organizes this by creating some of the most beautiful poetry that the world has ever seen. Really culminating, the kind of the pillar of this is his a Commedia, right, the Divine Comedy, where a man who is taken, well, it's about him, and he meets the poet Virgil, who, ancient Roman, the great poet Virgil, who takes him on a journey to actually find out what heaven is. The real kicker is that the journey to heaven takes him through hell, and so it's a beautiful tale about you know, well, not to talk about it too much, but you have something parallel going on in the English language, right? This all applies to Italian, but what about English? With English, you had somebody called Chaucer, who was actually writing in kind of a, I guess this is Middle English, but this is how it sounded back then. This is the beginning, the prologue of the Canterbury Tales. One that April with his sure sorte, the director of March has passed to the rote, and bathed every vein in sweet liquor, of which virtu engendered is a flour. When Zephyrus eke with his sweet breath, in spirit hath in every halt and heath, the tender crops and the youngest son, athin the ram his alpha cores run. The smaller falls make in melody, that sleep another night with open ye. This is what it means. When April with his sweet showers has pierced the drought of March to the root, and bathed every vein in such moisture as has power to bring forth a flower, when also Zephyrus with his sweet breath has breathed spirit into the tender new shoots, in every wood and meadow and the young sun has run half his course in the sign of the ram, and small birds sing melodies and sleep with their eyes open all the night. It goes on like this. It's incredibly beautiful, but you lose a lot in the translation. So you're still not exactly talking about English in the sense that we understand it. Where did I put that Shakespeare? Oh, great. So this is just a brief thing from Shakespeare, who is again, you know, going back into this idea of language as music and the power of ideas and developing a system of communicating these ideas to really do justice to the ideas which themselves cannot be expressed literally. This is from Act 5, Scene 1, Theseus in A Midsummer Night's Dream. More strange than true, I never believed these antique fables nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes, and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Such tricks hath strong imagination. And this is something that is developed through the present day. John, you're going to do something, Percy Shelley? It's you. Okay. Act 5, Scene 1 from A Midsummer Night's Dream by Theseus.
Are you going to come up after me?
Yeah, you're after. All right. This is Percy Shelley. Swiftly walk over the western wave, spirit of night. Out of the misty eastern cave, where all the long and lone daylight, thou wovest dreams of joy and fear, which make thee terrible and dear. Swift be thy flight. Now that was pretty boring, right? People were like, probably looking at me, what is he? Didn't he learn to read at all? Right. But I want everybody to say, you betrayed me.
You betrayed me.
Now say, you betrayed me.
You You betrayed me?
So there's it's all the same three words. But what's interesting is how the natural human speaking voice can convey the different ideas simply based on the inflections. And, you know, you get this is what LaRouche talks about, how the speaking voice and bel canto are one thing. And this is why you do bel canto warm-ups in the morning before you speak. Before you speak a word, do your bel canto warm-ups. And it's really necessary once you take out this quality in the speaking voice, and once you dumb down the language to a point where you don't need these inflections, you lose a lot of the emotional attachment to the idea. You really, really lose a lot of the quality. And so the key is beginning to investigate, well, exactly what is going on. What are the principles that are causing these necessities? You know, and it's different for different languages. You know, English needs inflections in certain points. You know, we've got some Chinese scholars who can tell you that there's different necessary inflection points with Chinese. There's, you know, and you get this throughout the different languages, where there's much more musical languages. You heard Danny reciting some Greek, where it sounds like every other one's just kind of flying up in the air. But that's necessary in the language. Yeah. So you get a sense of this, and this is also where when you're setting. I took this. I don't have time, but I took this stanza that I read, and I set it just to simple music. And you take the inflection points. It's interesting. You take the inflection points on which you know are necessary to convey the idea, and you begin to get a sense of, well, you necessarily need the register shifts for these inflections. The music has to adhere to the same way you would read the poetry. But the idea is, the idea of the composer is to actually uplift the poetry with the music. But we'll go through that another time. So I'm just going to reread this. Swiftly walk over the western wave, spirit of night. Out of the misty eastern cave, where all the long and lone daylight, thou wovest dreams of joy and fear, which make thee terrible and dear. Swift be thy flight. So you get a sense, right? There's a just complete shift. How the punctuation that the poet's using, the commas at the end of the lines, give the ability to hold the idea, you know. The same with the drama. You don't want to just pound the words away. You actually want to think about what the author is trying to convey. Because if you choose a certain inflection, it's going to convey a certain idea. If you decide to have some sort of downward inflection on a very important word that the author chose to, you know, upwardly inflect, then you're going to be changing the idea in which the poet was trying to convey, and that's where the genius of the poet comes in. It's trying to convey a very specific idea with the poetry. And so, with that said, this really leads into, well, if speech, regular speech has some ordering, if regular speech has a necessity, and there's a quality which needs to be upheld, then this, in my mind, this is the real idea behind the freedom of speech, is protecting this quality, this ability to convey ideas. And this is one of our very most, you know, sacred rights in the United States, and we take it for granted. We're completely destroying the English language. Know what I'm saying?
Declaration. All the articles.
All right, so what we're going to do right now is we're going to read the Declaration of Independence, specifically because I found out 2 days ago, no, 3 days ago, that not everyone in the United States has ever read the, not everyone in the United States has read the Declaration of Independence. And then I'll say a few words afterwards.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are insufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
Yeah. Okay. So, all I really want to say about that, because it really does speak for itself, that it was the first human, it was the first humanist government. Before this, everyone was a slave. Everyone. And the only political action that you could do was being a slave. And as being a slave. So you had people like Joan of Arc, you had people who did things, but now you actually created the potential through ideas. And it took from Plato, who wrote the Republic, who wrote the dialogues, Shakespeare, Kauscher, to actually create a situation, politically acting through their art, through their literature. You had artists like Mozart, who did so as well, to try to create a government where people can be free. Free to think. Free to use their mind. And someone like Poe did.
Alright, so Lyndon LaRouche is not the only one who has been slandered. We have people like Dante and Poe. So what we're going to read right now is a first part of, first few paragraphs. Oh, well, the first paragraph of the Murders in the Rue Morgue. But Frankie's going to read another version. I mean,
yeah, this is the The Murders in the Rue Morgue. This is what Neil's saying is that my version is the Griswold version, which is a version which was put out by this man named Henry Griswold, who got the rights of the works of Poe after Poe had died. He bought it from the aunt of Poe. and he had his way with the writings in the way of changing them and stricking out passages. So here's just one example. Beginning of the murders in the Rue Morgue.
This is, he's going to read the Griswold one, so listen.
The mental features discoursed of as the analytical are in themselves but little susceptible of analysis. We appreciate them only in their effects. We know of them, among other things, that they are always to their possessor, when inordinately possessed, a source of the liveliest enjoyment. As the strong man exults in his physical ability, delighting in such exercises as call his muscles into action, so glories an analyst in the moral activity which disentangles. He derives pleasure from even the most trivial occupations, bringing his talent into play. He is fond of enigmas, of conundrums, of hieroglyphics, exhibiting in his solutions of each a degree of acumen, which appears to the ordinary apprehension preternatural. His results, brought about by the very soul and essence of method, have in truth the whole air of intuition.
So that's his first paragraph. It started with the mental features. Okay, there's something about the mental feature. I'm going to read you my first paragraph, I mean this first paragraph with this book. Yeah. So, his book started with the mental features. Mine says, okay, the murders in the Rue Morgue. It is not improbable that a few farther steps in phrenological science will lead to a belief in the existence, if not to the actual discovery and location of an organ of analysis. If this power, which thought into its elements, be not, in fact, an essential portion of what late philosophers term ideality, then there are indeed many good reasons for supposing it a primitive faculty. That it may be a constituent of ideality is here suggested in opposition to the vulgar dictum, founded upon the assumptions of grave authority, that the calculating and discriminating powers, causality and comparison, are at variance with the imaginative, that the three, in short, can hardly coexist. But although thus opposed to received opinion, the idea will not appear ill-founded when we observe that the processes of invention or creation are strictly akin with the processes of resolution, the former being nearly, if not absolutely, the latter conversed. And goes to the second paragraph. It cannot be doubted that the mental features discourse of as the analytical are in themselves but little susceptible of analysis. So you can see there that this guy Griswold just removed the whole first paragraph. And why would he do that? There's an idea in the first paragraph that it talks about how a human mind works. It doesn't work as 1 + 1, you get 2. There's a process out there, how you get to the answer of seeking out truth. It's not, this is how Griswold looks at human beings. He hates human beings. He hates how human beings think. And he doesn't like how Poe writes it. I mean, yeah, why would Poe do that? Why would Poe write it that way? To make you engaged in the process of you're the one who's figuring out the truth. He's saying, I'm not going to tell you the answer. You're the one who's going to figure it out. So.
The thing with the language, which just exists in general, specifically in this passage, what Griswold, or what Poe is stating is that there's an investigative organ, which is essentially that ability of the human mind for hypothesizing things, which really don't exist in whatever given sense objects which you're investigating, but that you must impose a hypothesis to test out, which is the characteristic which makes your mind human, which separates you from any and all other forms of life on the planet. Now, the thing with that is, how do you actually use a language which, prior to the introduction of a new idea, doesn't have the capability of expressing that idea within that language? LaRouche said in a recent paper that you have to abuse the language in order to bring about that new idea. And this is essentially what Poe does in most of this trilogy we've been going through, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, The Mystery of Marie Roget, and The Purloined Letter. And he's always hitting on this idea of hypothesizing, that he's bringing in his own idea of what's going on with the given sense objects that are available. Like in The Purloined Letter, there's a series of investigations conducted at this French minister's house where they're looking for this letter, which was taken from this, I guess, the queen or something. And, I'll get to it. The prefects used a bunch of analytical devices to search this house, but they couldn't find anything. But what they didn't ask the question was, well, what is the nature of the person that's hiding this letter? They found that DuPont found out that he was a mathematician as well as a poet. And as the story proceeds, the minister, which they're investigating, actually played a trick with this purloined letter, where he just put the letter out in the midst, in front of everybody. It was a little dirty and folded, but the prefix just completely overlooked it because it was placed in such an obvious spot. They figured, hey, why would he put it in such an obvious spot? But DuPont ended up figuring it out. So I wanted to also go through this idea of, well, to develop this idea of the hypothesis of our ability to impose an idea which doesn't exist within the certain given sense-percepted objects. And it has to do with this idea of analysis situs, of being able to direct the change in whatever given circumstance that you're in, that you have to understand the geometry in which you're situated in to produce a knowable change. One example of this is, I was going to read a passage of this system of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather. It's quite an interesting... I'll just read this part to it. This is... they're discussing this thing called the soothing system, where this the character of the story goes into this insane asylum, and he's wants to know more about this system of soothing, the so-called system of soothing, which is being in use.
We don't have time.
We don't have time for this.
No. Sorry. We're cutting into Phil's time right now. All right. I was going to read something from the Science of Christian Economy where LaRouche goes through language, but we really, really don't have time. But basically, Lynn breaks down language into three forms. You have spoken, the language of vision, which is essentially geometry, and the language of hearing, which is actually music. And the three work together to create a people who actually have the infrastructure, the cognitive infrastructure to communicate powerful ideas, powerful and profound ideas. And this is what contributes to their ability to work together and live together in the form of a nation state. And so people who don't know, this is the book that Lin actually wrote while he was in prison. He thought he was going to die, and he basically, over the phone, I guess like five minutes a day? 5 minutes a day, that's how long our beloved government gave Mr. LaRouche to speak to his people, to try to get this book out. And he recited this book from memory, and he didn't. He wasn't killed. He managed to stay alive despite George Bush Sr. And we have it. But we also have the elaboration that LaRouche can make personally. But this is what we've done is we've actually assembled kind of a team of people in the youth movement that have the ability to investigate language from a very strong, well-rooted epistemological standpoint, in that we know what the real fight is. We know about scumbags like Griswold. We know about people like Edgar Allan Poe. But the question is, how many other people have been destroyed by these types of tactics? People like Theodore Adorno, you heard yesterday. People like Griswold, with Poe. But other people today that are the victims of basically the most... they're like bottom feeders. You know, they get more pleasure in destroying the beautiful than they would, knowing that they would never be able to create anything of real value for humanity. So they operate completely in the negative. But by this method, we can look at literature, not in just this kind of smorgasbord of great, great writers, but with an intention to act politically and bring about a revolution.
Know what I'm saying?
Vicky. 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 Vicky.